following lecture was produced by Glorian Publishing, a nonprofit organization, and is one of hundreds of lectures freely available via download, podcasts, streaming radio, and transcription. These lectures range in topic and complexity in order to address the many needs of humanity. We invite you to browse our library of lectures, books, courses, and articles to find teachings that suit you. Through the support of donations, Glorian Publishing has published 40 books, hosts international retreats several times a year, offers free online courses, and many other valuable resources, available to anyone worldwide. All of this has been made possible by the financial support of listeners like you. Your donations make it possible for this free public service to reach thousands of people every day. To make a tax-deductible donation in any amount, even anonymously, visit GnosticTeachings.org. Now, with heartfelt wishes for the end of suffering for all creatures, we begin the lecture. May all beings be happy.
Gnosis is a Greek term that we use as the name of our tradition. And the word gnosis means knowledge, but it doesn't mean book knowledge. It doesn't mean intellectual knowledge. And it doesn't mean belief. Gnosis refers to a kind of knowledge that you acquire through experience. Something that you have done, you've experienced it, you've tasted it, you have lived it. That's gnosis. So in this series of lectures about spiritual experience, we're talking about Gnostic experience. And in that context, Gnostic does not mean a tradition. It does not mean a teacher or a book. It doesn't refer to one school. It refers to the type of experience that anybody can have, no matter where they're from, who they are, what they believe, what they think. That's because real experience is scientific. It isn't rooted in belief or in theories or doctrines or dogmas. Real experience is something that if you know how to reach it, you will have it, whether you believe it or not, whether you accept it in your mind or not. The example we often use is, you may not accept the government, you may not believe in the government, you may not like the government, but if you're in the territory ruled by that government, you have to abide by its laws. All of nature is like that. Nature is ruled by laws. Our bodies are ruled by laws. Our consciousness is ruled by laws. We study those laws by theories, by intellect, in order to understand how to have experience of what those laws point out to us, of what those laws allow. So in that context, gnosis, although it uses theory and you might say belief, is really about acquiring experience of the truth. And that needs to be very clear. When we study this type of teaching, the mind will get stuck in theories and beliefs because that's all the mind can do. Gnosis is not acquired by the mind. Gnosis can never be acquired by the mind. And by mind here, I mean intellect. I mean that part that we see in ourselves that thinks, the flowing of thought. That flowing of thought is not the consciousness. It is not the self. It is not the soul. The flow of thought can never experience gnosis. It can contemplate it. It can play with it. It can bat it around as a theory or as a belief or as something we accept or reject, but it can never experience gnosis. What experiences gnosis is consciousness. And this is what we've been trying to point out in this series. So that any person who wants real spiritual experience to have an actual experience of religion, to know what it is, not just to believe in it or think about it, but to know it. The main, first, most important thing you need to know is what your consciousness is. Not your mind, not your personality, not beliefs and theories, but consciousness. In Gnosis, we call the consciousness the essence. And that is because the word essence points towards something deep, something that's in everything. When we talk about the essence of a thing, we mean its fundamental truth. That which is most profound within something. Our essence is our consciousness. But that consciousness is not what we think it is. It is not our name. It is not our personality. It is not our experiences in this life. It isn't this body. It is not what we believe. It isn't what we wear, how we talk, how we think. It isn't our language, our country. It is nothing to do with our parentage, our lineage, our history, our country, our religion. Essence is eternal. Essence is immortal. In the sense that it is energy that does not die. Einstein pointed this out. Energy can never be destroyed. It can be changed. It can be modified. But it cannot be destroyed. Strangely, so-called spiritual people since the time of Einstein have not grasped what that scientific statement means spiritually in terms of religion. Einstein pointed out the truth, the reality of religion, because he was deeply religious. He experienced gnosis to his level, and that's how he was able to make the breakthroughs he made. He knew how to meditate. He knew how to use consciousness and learn through his intuition. Consciousness does not die. Now, when I use the term consciousness here, I'm talking about it in a very broad sense. Not as merely that spark of essence that is in us here and now physically. That spark, that essence in us now, is very small, with not much energy, and is weak. And that's why all of us have little to no spiritual experience, because that essence has not been grown. We don't use it consistently and daily. We use the intellect. We use the heart. We use the body. We ignore the soul, the consciousness. We don't use it. We've never learned how. This is the whole purpose of religion and spiritual studies, should be to teach us how to use consciousness, how to awaken. Awakening is not of the mind, the heart, the body. It has nothing to do with sensations. Awakening is in the consciousness, in the soul. So when I say consciousness, again, in this context, I'm talking about something much broader than the human soul. That immortal consciousness comes from beyond the soul. It's what gives birth to the soul. It's what gives the possibility of soul. And if that seems abstract, it is. The true nature of our being is abstract. About that, the Buddha, Shakyamuni, said something very profound. He said, "Transcendent wisdom is inexpressible and inconceivable, unborn and unceasing. It has the nature of space. It is realized through an individual's discernment. and is the object of pristine awareness. It is the mother of all Buddhas throughout the three periods of time. This statement from the Buddha is 100% Kabbalah. What he is teaching here is the nature of the absolute, the Ein Sof, which is, of course, our fundamental root, the being of our being, the ultimate essence of every existing thing. When we study the Tree of Life, which is this symbol of the Kabbalah, the 10 Sephiroth emerge from the absolute. The absolute is the void. In English, we sometimes use the word emptiness. But the word emptiness implies a lack of something. And emptiness is not that. It is something, but it is not anything that we can conceive of. It is, in Kabbalistic terms, uncreated light. Pure potentiality, beyond any form of measurement. It is unceasing. It is unborn. We call it the limitless light. And that's in Hebrew, Ein Sof, or. That limitless light, or limitless space, which is the Ein Sof, is the ultimate essence of anything. In Tibetan Buddhism, it is called the clear light. In Hinduism, it is called Prakriti, the divine mother space. And it's called the divine mother space because from it, everything is born. And that's why the Buddha says it is the mother of all Buddhas. The term Buddha means awakened one. To be a Buddha, one has to be awake as a consciousness. And to be a Buddha properly defined means that one is awake to the truth and is able to perceive the Ein Sof, to actually see it. Not in the future, but right now. To see the emptiness in all things. To see that all manifested elements, bodies, cities, countries, worlds, planets, suns, universes, are in their essence empty, void. They have in their heart Ein Sof. Our intellect cannot grasp that. And our physical eyes cannot see it. To see that, one needs different eyes. Eyes of consciousness, eyes of spirit. But they have to be awakened, they have to be opened through a precise science, which we call gnosis, which in the East is called dharma. Dharma means law, teaching, truth, something that is true, something fundamental. Dharma doesn't mean belief or a series of behaviors that one should imitate. That's not dharma. Nowadays, people think if they study dharma, they just have to imitate their teachers and follow certain steps. That is not dharma. That's imitation. And the same happens in gnosis. People think, I'm a Gnostic now, so I have to act certain ways, do certain things, and go to certain places, and do certain practices, and that makes me a Gnostic. No, it doesn't. It makes you an imitator. What makes one a Gnostic is to have gnosis, experience, knowledge. From experience. The Buddha said, transcendent wisdom is inexpressible and inconceivable. This means that there can be no concept of it in the intellect. This means that it cannot be expressed through words. That's because real knowledge cannot be expressed. Can you express to someone the taste of honey? Can you express to someone the experience of giving birth to a child? You cannot. These are experiences that one must have. And having had the experience, you have an understanding that you share with others who've had the same experience. That is gnosis and the sensual level. The experience of the Ein Sof, of these superior levels, is the same. It can't be expressed. You can't conceive of it. You can't even imagine it, because the experience of it is what transmits the knowledge, the gnosis. And he says, unborn and unceasing, it has the nature of space. The absolute is the fundamental ground of everything, anywhere, anytime. In Sanskrit, we study cosmic days and cosmic nights, manvantaras and pralayas, or great cosmic days and great cosmic nights, maha manvantaras and maha pralayas. These are huge cosmic ages of billions of years. And in those cosmic ages, the universes, the infinites, expand out of the prakriti, like the breath of God, as it says in Kabbalah. God exhales and everything comes into existence. And God inhales and withdraws it all back into that womb of nature, which is the absolute, the nothingness, the uncreated light. That is what's here on the top of the tree of life. That state of potential existence. And when existence unfolds, all the dimensions of nature come into being because of karma, cause and effect. And when the karmas are satisfied and the age is drawing to a close, it's all withdrawn back into the absolute. These are cycles at the levels of gods, life and death of universes. But all of that that exists, that can be known, withdraws back into the unknowable. It is unborn. It is unceasing. It is without attributes. When we apply that concept to ourselves, then we have to look within and realize that this whole tree of life that maps the outer world also maps our inner world. In ages past, we also entered into manifestation. Here we are as a physical body, Malkut, the 10th Sephira. This physical body exists because of other forms of energy and matter that give it the possibility to be alive. We call these the internal bodies. Vital body, astral body, mental body, causal body, which are these superior sephiroth on the tree of life. Here we have our spirit, the monad, our inner father, our inner Buddha. But that inner Buddha exists because of the Trimurti above, the Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, Keter, Chokmah, Binah, the being of the being, the Father of the Father. But this Trinity, which we could also call the cosmic Christ, the solar logos, only exists because it manifests out of the absolute. So here we see this beautiful structure of the divinity within every existing soul, every creature, every living thing. And this is why I was saying that consciousness, in its root, is emptiness. In its root is space. Every living creature, in its ultimate essence, is Ein Sof. It is empty. It is void. Look inside your own mind. How much of that can you perceive? Nothing. When we look in our mind, we only see the stale thoughts that we keep repeating every day. the tired worries, the surging desires, dissatisfaction, discontentment, curiosity, craving, fear, aversion, pride, anger, resentment, gluttony, laziness, lust. That's what we see in our thoughts, in our feelings, in our dreams. This is why we suffer. We suffer because of the consequences of our previous actions. We suffer because the light that flows in our three brains, in our intellect, in our heart, and through our bodies is misused to feed desire, to chase pleasure, to avoid pain, to nourish and sustain a false sense of self. We grasp at an identity that does not exist. We construct a house to live in that is false, a psychological house that has our name, our tastes, our interests, our traumas, and we think it's real, and it isn't. It is self-deception. And every human being on the planet is making it worse day by day because we don't know how to use the consciousness to break the cage. That cage, that psychological trap, was made by us, not by God. That psychological cage that we live in, that traps our consciousness in cravings, in fears, in anxieties, in worries, in Christianity, is called Satan. The devil. In Gnosis, we call it the ego. In Buddhism, they call it skandhas, aggregates. In Hinduism, they call it samskaras, and a variety of other names. Whatever name we apply to it, the meaning is simply this. Because we've been entranced by desire, by sensation, we've taken the energies that flow through us and fed desire and made desire stronger. And every time we feed a desire, it gets stronger. And the consequence is karma, cause and effect. The desire is stronger. It traps energy. It traps consciousness. That's why we suffer. The Bible says, ye shall reap what ye sow. We suffer because we have forgotten God. Not a God outside, not a God in the clouds, but in the depths of us. From moment to moment, we forget that God is inside the heart. God is inside our atoms. God is inside our breath. God is inside sex. God is inside every motion and movement of matter and energy everywhere. But our ego, our desire, our Satan, makes us feel and think and believe that God is not here. I don't see God. I can't hear God. I don't experience God. It's just me here, and I'm hungry. And I'm lustful, and I'm angry. So we think those are the only realities. And that's why we suffer. And we suffer more and more. We become attracted to religion because we want freedom from that. This is what liberation means. Liberation means freedom from the false self. Freedom from suffering. Freedom from pain. Freedom from anxiety. From sadness. From anger. From lust. Liberation means to have a mind that is serene and joyful. To have a heart that is peaceful and loving. To have a body that is relaxed and content. Those can be our reality if we produce the causes that bring those effects. In other words, liberation is karmic. No one can become liberated by belief, by wearing a robe, or taking a vow. No one becomes liberated by evolution. There are many spiritual groups who proclaim that humanity is on an evolving path and eventually all human beings will become free from suffering and become great enlightened angels. This is a lie. There is no evidence for that anywhere, not in any scripture and not in nature. Everything in nature answers to laws. Evolution is a process of complication of energy. Evolution is a mechanical law, but it has a sister or a polar opposite, which is devolution. Just as something is born and grows, it evolves and becomes fully expressed. Also, everything that reaches that stage devolves. It decays and dies. This is what we see in humanity, a process of devolution. Humanity is not getting better. Humanity is getting worse. We don't like to see it or think about it or hear it, but all of us know in our hearts that things are getting worse from year to year, from generation to generation. If we look back a few generations, yeah, our parents may have had it tough in some ways, but things were not nearly as complicated as they are now, not nearly as dangerous, not nearly as polluted, not as close to the brink of absolute disaster as we are now. Never in the history of this planet have we been in so much danger as today. So there is no evidence that humanity is evolving and becoming better. What we see is that the ego is getting stronger. Pornography is spreading like wildfire worldwide and rotting and destroying the hearts and minds of children all over the world, destroying them. Through pornography and violent imagery and violent behaviors, the sensitivities of the heart are destroyed. The children of today have lost the innocence and beauty of the children of yesterday. And the parents and adults of today are insensitive to that, have lost sight of it, because they also have been corrupted by lust and anger. And the politicians and wealthy don't care. They just want more money and power. For us as individuals who want to know religion and experience religion, we have to isolate ourselves from all those negative influences and begin to work on the contents of our mind. Satan, or the Antichrist, is not outside of us. It isn't a politician. It isn't a terrorist. It is our mind. Our own mind that is Antichrist. This light that emerges out of the absolute in order to create existence is a ray of light, the Ein Sof Or. The first expression of that ray is the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. That Trinity, or Trimurti, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, in its unity is a three-in-one that we can call Christ. Christos, fire, light, intelligence, wisdom. It is the crown of life mentioned in Revelation. It is not a thing. It is not a person. It is an energy. It is the pure, perfect expression of the most perfect existing level of life. Its defining characteristic is sacrifice, love, cognizance. These are all one thing. In Sanskrit terms, we can call that perfect pure light Dharmakaya. That means body of the law, body of the truth. Dharma is truth. Kaya is a vehicle or vessel, a means of expression. Dharmakaya. We don't experience that in ourselves, down here in our physical bodies, in the third dimension. We experience the ego. That ego is anti-Christ. Our ego doesn't care about sacrifice for others unless we're going to get something out of it. If we're going to get praise or recognition, then sure, we'll sacrifice, we'll give, we'll donate to charity, we'll go serve in a hostel or at the food bank if we're going to get a little good feeling about it. If people are going to be nice to us and praise us, we'll do it for pride. We'll do it for guilt, because we feel guilty. But how rare do we do something for others because we love them? Because they need it. And we don't care about ourselves and what we get from it or how much it costs us. We do it because we must. Because it's right. That is Christic. That kind of sacrifice. To give because it must be done. So our mind is anti-Christ. This is why our teacher Samael Onvior said, "The Satan that we carry within is composed of atoms of the secret enemy. Satan had a beginning. Satan has an end. We need to dissolve Satan in order to return to the inner star that has always smiled upon us. This is the true final liberation. Only by dissolving the I can we attain absolute liberation." This short passage defines this entire teaching. If you want to know what Gnosis is about, that's it. Absolute liberation. Not temporary liberation. Not a few moments of pleasure in samadhi. Not a few moments of pleasure in the astral plane or in the mental plane or in the causal plane. Not a few moments of ecstasy out of the body. Not a few moments of ecstasy in the body. Absolute liberation. Do you notice that term? Absolute liberation is in the inner star that has always guided us. That is the Ein Sof. That is where we find liberation. In the Ein Sof, in the emptiness, in the void. Because of that, we need to study. We need to study the teachings, and we need to study ourselves. The tree of life that I just showed you is a symbol that we study in order to understand something about nature and about our own constitution, spiritually and psychologically. But it's easy to start to take that tree of life literally and to start to believe that these levels not really good with this technology stuff. Wrong way. Here. it's easy to start to believe that this map is literal. And people start to think that the third dimension, where we are right now, is right here. This is Malkut. And that the fourth dimension, Yesod, is above my head. And it's partly because we grew up in Sunday school thinking heaven is up above in the clouds. It's wrong. It's not right. Heaven is not above us. Hell is not below our feet. Both heaven and hell, nirvana and samsara, are inside of us. When we lie down to sleep and we have dreams, where are those dreams? What do they correspond to? They correspond to what's in us. When we dream, do we go to heaven or do we go to hell? You have to answer that for yourself. If you're in a place where you're only experiencing the contents of your own mind, you work all day and then at night you dream at work, you're in hell. A place that constantly repeats. If you have nightmares, you're in hell. These Sephiroth on the Tree of Life are inside of us. Levels and levels inside. The fourth dimension, which corresponds to Yesod, is our vital energy. If you've studied acupuncture or Tai Chi, Qigong, Neigong, Dumo, any of these types of practices, you're working with the energy of the fourth dimension. That is inside of you. If you've had a dream out of your body, an experience out of your body, that's the fifth dimension. Hod and Netzach, astral and mental planes. That's inside. If you've been so fortunate to experience the sixth dimension, that's Tiferet, Gebura, and Chesed. That's inside, not outside. It's not somewhere over there. It's not above us. It's not down the street. It isn't in some other place that we can barely imagine. It's inside. How do you experience that? By knowing the laws. By knowing how to use consciousness. By knowing how to meditate. So this next image is the same Tree of Life, but organized more accurately. Really, the Tree of Life, all the Sephiroth that represent all the different dimensions of nature, in some places you hear it's described as a fountain. And the water flows out of the smallest into the next, into the lowest, and below, and below, and below, and creates everything. That's a good illustration. This graphic, which was created by Manly P. Hall in the early 20th century, represents the four worlds of Kabbalah, organized as concentric spheres. In the case of this graphic, it's demonstrating levels of density. The densest is the center of this particular graphic, which is us, Asya. In the Bible, it's mistakenly translated as Asia. So in the book of Revelation, it says the seven churches in Asia, it should be the seven churches of Asya, which means the physical world, the body, the physical body. But this is only an example illustrating density. The reality would be to invert what this graphic is showing and to realize this outer sphere is your body. Third dimensional matter and energy. If you learn to meditate in the right way, consciously awake, and you inquire within, and you are persistent, very relaxed, and know how to harness energy, you can go deeper and deeper. What you might say is higher and higher, but really it's deeper into your depths, past the vital energy, chi, past emotion, the astral body, past thought, the mental body, past consciousness, the causal body, past divine consciousness, the divine soul, Geburah, past spirit, Chesed, past the Holy Spirit, Binah, past the Son, Chokmah, past Keter, the Father of the Father, until you hit Ein Sof, our inner star, the void, the emptiness. Anyone here can do that because you have it inside. We all have this inside, but we don't know how to use our consciousness. So as soon as we sit to meditate and start looking within, we get distracted by desire. Desires for more comfort, desires for experiences, desires to be done with this already, desires to not have to work hard and just get it. Please, God, give me an experience. Please, God, I want to experience the astral plane, or I want to see you, or I want to go to the Tibet. I want to go to Mars. We want to have all these types of spiritual experiences without having earned them and without knowing how to have them at will. We're lazy. We don't practice seriously. A serious meditator does not give up. A serious meditator meditates every day. I'm talking about proper sitting meditation, not moving. Not moving. Swami Sivananda points this out beautifully, and I meant to mention it in a previous lecture. He describes in one of his books how our asana or posture should be. He said it should be like a mountain. It does not move. He said that we should be able to sit perfectly still for 3 hours without even a flicker of motion. That degree of stability is what is necessary for the consciousness to penetrate deeply inside. If we're constantly distracted by physical sensations, oh, my knee hurts, or that guy's playing his guitar next door, or the incense is getting in my nose and it's bothering me, or the kids are yelling upstairs, whatever it is, you can never experience this because you're still got your attention in the physical world. Experiences in meditation come when you abandon the physical world completely. He also states in another book, quite beautifully, that a full, true dhyana or samadhi, an absorption, is marked by the consciousness leaving physicality completely. The physical body remains there and functions, but the soul is not there. You cannot have that experience if you're so focused in paying attention to the physical body. If you want genuine spiritual experience, put your body in its posture, relax it deeply, and forget about it. Put all of your attention, 100%, into diving inside, into the darkness, like an arrow. That's how you have it. This is why we study the stages of meditation. Every tradition presents it in different ways. But the essence of them all is the same: to break free of the chains that bind us. Those chains are laws. The tree of life that I showed you is a series of laws. Malkuth is our physicality. It's ruled by 48 laws. No, there is no list of the 48 laws, because those 48 laws are all the laws above it added up. The Ein Sof, which is that perfect, pure, limitless light, has no laws, only itself. That's why in that space is perfect freedom, perfect liberation. Nothing binds the essence. In the absolute, there is no bondage. There is perfect freedom. Absolute and complete freedom of movement. No limitations. Limitless is its name in Hebrew. limitless. That means there's no law except itself. That is reality. When that law expresses into manifestation, it starts to multiply. It becomes complicated. That is evolution. First, it becomes three laws, the Trinity. Then it becomes six laws, the monad. That monad is the three laws above multiplied, right? And when it descends further into the realm of 12 laws, which is Netzach, it is the other laws added up to this one. It's just mathematical complications of matter and energy. What this means for us is, here in our physical body, when we take our energy, mental energy, emotional energy, physical energy, sexual energy, and we feed desire, we feed anger and pride and envy and lust and gluttony and greed and fear and all of the other discursive emotions that make us suffer, we complicate that energy. We create karma, cause and effect. And the more we do it, the more complicated those egos become. And the denser and darker and heavier our mind and heart become. Have you noticed that the city feels heavy and the country feels light? That is those laws. When you're approaching a place where there are a lot of people, you start to feel the heaviness of the laws that modify the consciousness of that region, of the people there. You feel it. This is why we long for vacations. We want a break from all the laws. This is why we long to have astral experiences out of the body, because those regions are free of all the heavy laws that we have here. But those are not ultimate liberation. They're temporary. When we go on a vacation, we have to come back. Many people enter religion burdened by the laws, and they just want to go become a monk or a nun or a priest to have a simpler life and escape the laws. That's only a temporary, superficial freedom. Because the bondage is in the mind. It isn't in the external circumstances. The bondage that we have, the suffering that we have, is inside. From 96 laws to 864. Dante, in his Inferno, demonstrated this. Dante was a great Gnostic. His Divine Comedy is 100% pure Kabbalah, describing his experiences and showing the people, this is what happens to your mind when you engage in treason, lust, pride, envy, gluttony, greed, avarice. This is what happens to your mind. We become those people trapped in hell. Here and now, in the body, trapped in hell. Yeah, hell exists as a place. It does. And heaven exists as a place. But our relationship with them is defined now by who we are today. If you want to know if you're going to go to heaven, look into the state of your mind. That will tell you. If your mind and heart vibrate at the level of heaven, then you will go there. And if your mind and heart vibrate at the level of hell, you're already there. It's quite simple and terrifying. So liberation comes, absolute liberation comes, by dissolving the Antichrist, the ego. This requires a daily, constant effort. Yes, effort. Effort means an expenditure of energy. Rather than expending our energy trying to avoid things we don't like and chasing things we do like and continually complicating our existence, it would be better to expend energy contemplating that existence. Analyzing, why do we suffer? How do I get myself in these positions? How is it that I do this to myself and others? What is it in me that causes me to be here suffering and causes others to suffer with me? And this is not just from time to time when a big traumatic event happens. This is a daily effort. It's in that daily effort, expenditure of energy, that wisdom begins to emerge. We start to see the patterns of our lives, to see the tendencies that we have ignored previously. We become our own psychologist. But something that we have to understand is this. Liberation, real liberation, is not in the physical world. To really comprehend yourself, to really see your ego, to really see your mind, you have to learn to get out of the cage. When you're in the cage, you can't see it for what it is because you're used to it, accustomed to it. It's become a habit. To really see the cage, you have to get out of the cage. And the best way to do that is through meditation. And that's why this course began with the quotes. It is impossible to experience the reality, the being, unless we become masters of meditation. To be a master of meditation means that one has to be able to practice and perform at will and experience the being. Now, if any of you have studied modern theories about things, they say nowadays that to develop skill with something, to be actually good at it, you need to spend at least 10,000 hours. Has anyone here meditated for 10,000 hours yet? No? But I'll tell you that it takes more than that. That study about 10,000 hours is related with playing golf, driving a car, things that are not profound. To become a master of meditation, honestly, takes lifetimes. In reality. The reason we need meditation is because here in the physical body, using our physical senses, we can see the third dimension. That's it. We see Malkuth. We see the world ruled by 48 laws, nothing more. The ego is not there. The effects of the ego are there. We see our thoughts and feelings. We see the impulses that drive us. But those impulses come from somewhere deeper that we can't see. Psychologists call it the unconsciousness, the subconsciousness. Regions of the mind that the physical senses and even our ability to perceive thought can't see because it's too deep. To see that, we have to escape this cage, the physical body. We need to open other senses. That same sense that you have that can be aware of a thought, that can be aware of a feeling, is consciousness. You don't sense thoughts and feelings with taste, touch, hearing, sight, but with something inside. That sense, that ability to visualize, is the ability to meditate. But it needs discipline and skill. A lot of practice. When we learn that, we learn to escape the third dimension. This is what we call visions, out-of-body experiences, meditative experiences. Some people call it samadhi or dhyana, absorptions. Some people call it enlightenment or liberation. It isn't. It's temporary, but it isn't full liberation or full enlightenment. It's temporary. We escape the third dimension, and from that we may experience the fourth or fifth dimensions. The fourth dimension is related with energy. That is Eden. We can experience Eden. We can also experience the fifth dimension, which is Nirvana. We can also experience the inverted aspect of Nirvana, which is Samsara. This is hell. It's also the fifth dimension. All of that can be had through meditation. But all of that is still subject to the influences of the ego. This is why meditators who learn to experience these things will suddenly have a vision or getting out of the body, and they'll get super excited or scared and come back to the body. And that's because the ego still modifies those realms. That is fear, pride, anger, lust, and desire. All of the different thousands of varieties of ego. to really be able to comprehend oneself, one has to leave third, fourth, and fifth dimensions and enter the sixth dimension. This is why Samael-Envior stated this. Beyond the three known dimensions, physical dimension, length, width, and height, exists the fourth dimension. This is time. Beyond time, we have the fifth dimension, and this is eternity. Moreover, we asseverate that beyond eternity, a sixth dimension exists. The sixth dimension is beyond eternity and time. And the sixth dimension is where total liberation begins. Therefore, only the person who awakens in all the six fundamental dimensions of nature or space is a true clairvoyant, a turiya, a legitimate enlightened one. The sixth dimension. Why? Here's the tree of life again. Remember, these levels are inside, not above our heads, but inside. Our physical body relates to the third dimension. Our energy, the fourth. Our emotions and thoughts relate to the fifth. Think about that. When you meditate, what stops you from going deeper? Discursive energy. We're stressed, we're tense. We can't relax. We want to do things. We want to run around. We're busy. That's energy. That is, our vital body is disturbed. Or we've been drinking alcohol or smoking cigarettes, or we've been getting really agitated or stressed out. All of that disturbs the energies of the vital body. It cannot relax. Thus, if the vital body cannot relax, the physical body cannot relax. Thus, we cannot meditate. Simple. It's a law. We have to go beyond the third dimension, physical body. We have to go beyond the fourth dimension, energy, in the physical body. And then if we, let's say we get very relaxed. Let's say we go on a retreat and we meditate very focused for a few days and we become very relaxed physically and energetically. What's going to stop us next? Emotion. In Hod. Thoughts in Netzach. What is emotion? We're worried about work. We're worried about the cat. We wish we had a boyfriend. We wish we had somebody who would appreciate us and love us. We can't believe that our parents are so cruel and mean, and our heart is tied up in a knot because people are so insensitive to our needs. We can't meditate because the heart, the astral body, is agitated. We are identified with emotion. Always wrapped up in our emotional needs. In other words, a false self. Desire, emotionally. Let's say we get past that. Even more subtle is thought. Thinking about this, thinking about that, memories from the past, desires and thoughts about the future, daydreaming, fantasies. Trying to figure out things. We're curious. I wonder if she really likes him. I wonder if he really likes her. I wonder if he likes me. Thinking, imagining, trying to figure out things. Even analyzing a teaching. I don't get all this Kabbalah stuff. What does this mean about this and that? Thought. How am I going to pay the bills? I've got to think about this. How am I going to get a job? I have to think about it. These are all thoughts rooted in false sense of self. The mental body is agitated, disturbed. It can't relax. Thus, we cannot meditate. Are you getting the point? What is meditating is not the body, not the vital body. It isn't the astral body. It isn't the mental body. In reality, we need to go beyond all of that and see what it is in us that's actually trying to meditate. We need to look into that which is looking. Look into that space between thoughts. Look into the place between feelings, between sensations. What's there? Don't answer with your intellect. Look. What's there? Can you find a self? We all say thoughts and feelings and sensations come from the self. Where is that self? Who is it? When you look into your mind now, can you find it? Can you follow a thought back to the self it came from? Can you follow a feeling back to the feeling or the self that that feeling came from? Or a sensation, a memory, a dream, a worry? Can you find it? You cannot. This is basic Zen practice. Basic Dzogchen as well. That inquiry into one's mind is a looking through the Sephiroth. Looking in, remember that rings of concentric spheres, that is that. The consciousness looking at the spaces between things, the emptiness. I don't know if you've realized it, but I'm giving you a really big clue for your meditation practice. If you follow this advice seriously, you can make rapid progress in your meditation. I didn't make this up. I learned this from someone else, from Samael and Vior. That looking, inquiring, never becoming attached, maintaining freedom, not letting anything bind you, no energy, no sensation, no thought, no emotion, no longing, no desire. But the one thing is to keep looking deeper, looking within, moving aside in between everything that emerges, a constant inquiry. This is not easy to acquire or accomplish. It's very challenging. And the reason is because the mind, the ego, will do everything in its power to keep us distracted. Its chief tool, duality. Dualism. You're sitting to meditate and you want to have an experience. So the ego comes and says, "You can't." We've all experienced that. Defeatism. The ego saying, "You can't. You don't deserve it. You don't have the right book. You don't have a good teacher. You don't have a good school. Your being, your innermost, your Buddha, doesn't care about you, has forgotten about you. You've never had an experience of your divine mother. How do you know any of that's real?" So you give up. The ego uses any tool it can get to distract us, to keep us asleep. It uses images, thoughts, feelings, sensations, everything in the mind that it has access to. It will bring you desires and play them in the screen of your mind in order to make you dream. It will bring you longings, doubts, fears. It will bring you anything it can that can keep you thinking, "I can get something better than I have now." That is the fundamental dualism of the mind. I don't want what I have. I want something more. That duality, that conflict, is at the root of suffering. Craving and aversion. I want to avoid what I have, and I want to get what he has or she has. So we read the great masters of meditation and we say, "I want what they have." Well, at first there's a little sincerity in there because the soul needs that and wants that. But then the mind takes it and makes it into envy. The mind takes that and says, "I want that for me." And then pride says, "I deserve it. I want to feel good about myself. I want others to admire me and respect me, so I want those experiences. So then I can get up in front of everybody and start talking about all these great spiritual things." Envy, pride. That's what keeps us from having experiences. Lust also. Constant desire for sensation, for pleasure, for satisfaction. It is that dualism that keeps us trapped. It is the battle in the mind that keeps us trapped. The antidote is cognizance, knowledge, gnosis, experience. There are many people who become enthusiastic about these kinds of studies, and they'll get, you know, very interested in it for a while, and they'll practice meditation seriously, and they'll read books, and they'll go to classes, and they will be all fired up about religion for a while. And then the resistance comes. The ego fights back. The ego does not want to die. We love our personalities. We love our suffering. We love to complain about our suffering. We love to be pitied for our suffering. We love sympathy from others. We love to look the best, and we love to look the worst. We like to be the bad boy or the bad girl, and we like to be the best one. We hate to be in the middle. This is the dualism of the mind. Cognizance means you don't care. Cognizance means that you know you are what you are, no matter what anyone says or thinks. Cognizance knows God is. Cognizance is a kind of wisdom that is based in experience of the fundamental truth. Cognizance is not intellectual knowledge. It is knowing from experience. It is gnosis. This is what students need to overcome resistance. Cognizance. Everyone who studies this type of teaching will experience enormous resistance in surges and waves from their own mind. It will come in surges. Sometimes the surges are unbelievably strong and can last a long time. It takes a lot of willpower to ride the wave and not get sucked into the depths of defeatism, despair, or even worse, to go back to one's old life, one's old behaviors. It takes a lot of willpower. What will fuel it is cognizance, conscious memory, work memory. This is why experiences are important. Spiritual experiences are important. Not for the ego, but to strengthen the soul, the consciousness. We come to religion, to gnosis, because we want experiences and we want to know the truth. And in the beginning, sometimes, for some people, experiences come easily, even rapidly. And this is a great gift, a donum Dei, that the being gives to his human soul, which is you, not your mind, your consciousness. The being will give you gifts and say, see, this is real. And the soul will become inflamed with enthusiasm. But that can't last because the soul can become attached. It can become seduced by the mind and become attached to experiences. And this happens all the time to everyone. You have an experience out of the body or a vision, and you become so happy, and you feel the sensation, which is the most beautiful pleasure, the most beautiful joy you can ever imagine. Which is to feel one's soul free of the cage. To feel that liberation is so liberating that you want to continue it. You don't want to leave that. And you want it again and again. But that can become a desire. And when we don't get it, we become angry. We become despairing. And many people leave the teaching. They abandon their practice. They stop meditating. The antidote is to remember that experience was real. One experienced it and can have it again. But one has to pay one's karma. One has to pay one's debts. One needs to work on the ego. This is the point. This type of cognizance is superficial. It's a step along the way to deeper cognizance, deeper knowledge about the ultimate nature of self. Memory of an experience can only last so long and can only give you so much enthusiasm or faith. What's going to give you real lasting power to sustain a practice until you're finished is true cognizance of your actual inner nature. It is to abandon the idea that your physical body is your real self, to then comprehend that your astral body is also not your real self. Many people get stuck there and think, I've got to build my astral body, thinking that is the real self. It is not. They think that about the mental body, and then they think that about the causal body, that this is the real self. It is not. They are vessels. They're vehicles. Don't get attached. We have to break the chains that attach us to the physical body, the chains that attach us to the ego, the I, the chains that attach us to all the cravings for all the sensations, whether those sensations are in the third dimension, the fourth, or the fifth, even the sixth. Yes, we can become attached to heaven, to nirvana. This is how one becomes what's called a pratyeka Buddha, or a god in some traditions, a titan. These are people, human beings, who have reached a certain level of spiritual experience but become attached to the pleasure of those realms, to the power of those realms. They are Buddhas. They are gods. But with attachment. As you learn to meditate and go deeper in your practice, you will experience those levels. And you will enjoy the pleasure of those levels. And you will want to stay there. Don't become attached. It's a huge danger. Very few schools will teach you that, because most want you to become attached so they can build a bigger school. If you want absolute liberation, you have to break all the chains through all these dimensions, even in the sixth. Remember, Samael said, liberation begins in the sixth dimension. That's where it begins. This is because this is the level of causes. The causes for everything are found here in the sixth dimension. To investigate the causes of the ego, the causes of the I, the causes of suffering begins here in the sixth dimension. This means that you need to have a very robust skill in meditation to work in that level. Don't assume that you're going to get there today or even this year. It might take a lot of effort to clear a lot of garbage out of the mind until you reach the ability to have that and to work in that level. Doesn't matter how long it takes, how much effort it takes, but do it. Don't worry about time. Don't worry about obstacles. Stay true to the course. What this translates into is how we meditate every day. What's important here, what I'm trying to express is, whether you have an experience in nirvana or an experience in this or that heaven or an experience out of the body or a vision, wonderful. So what? Does it free you from suffering? Not temporarily, but ultimately. Do those experiences give you something that change your behavior? Because that is what we need. We need cognizance that changes our behavior. and you touch the stove and you're burned, you don't want to touch it again. That's cognizance. But we need that psychologically. We need to really become cognizant that anger hurts. Anger is pain. Pride is pain. Lust is pain. We have no cognizance of these things. Master Samael gives a beautiful example. He says the alcoholic knows that alcohol hurts him. He knows that alcohol is killing his cells in his brain and destroying his liver. He knows, but he does not have cognizance of it because he continues drinking. The one who has cognizance will never touch alcohol because they know that it damages them and is making more obstacles to their liberation from suffering. That is cognizance. And we need that with anger and lust and pride and envy and gluttony and greed and everything else that clogs up the mind. That kind of cognizance strengthens the soul, the consciousness. It makes it robust. It gives it energy. If you want to have real spiritual experiences, not just a few minutes in the astral plane flying around, not just a few minutes in the mental plane investigating this or that, but real experience of the truth. In the void, in the absolute, there is only one way to reach that, and that is to die as an ego, to eliminate pride and fear and lust and envy and gluttony and greed and everything else that traps the consciousness. You see, here's the science behind that is simple. Every time that we've committed an error and created an ego, we've created a knot in cosmic flow. Every I is a karmic chain link. When you become angry, that is what envelops you, is that link in the chain. And what you feel and sense in your body, in your heart, and in your intellect are all the expressions of that anger, that chain. But what empowers it? What is it that gives that anger the ability to know what the other person is thinking or doing? What is it that gives that anger the capacity of seeing and expressing itself? Anybody know? It's the consciousness. That anger is just a lens, a filter over you. You empower it. When lust entraps your mind and heart and body, and all you can see and think and feel is lust, what empowers it? You. Yourself. That's why the Master Samael said, don't say and think and feel that your I, your ego, is separate from you. It isn't. It is you. It is you doing it. That sense of separation between me and my ego is a lie. Because the one who's feeding and empowering that ego is you. And this is something many Gnostics get caught in, as they think, I'm not my ego, I'm my being. That's mythomania. That's pride. It's a misconception that keeps them off the path, off the inner path working on themselves. Because they think the pride is not themselves. That lust is not me. Yes, it is. What's trapped in that lust, what expresses through that lust, is you. Free it, and you will free from suffering. If you've studied any of the higher yoga tantras, like Mahamudra or Dzogchen, or, for example, the very beautiful and profound teachings of Milarepa, you will discover, also in the Maitreya, teachings from the Maitreya Buddha, there's a scripture called the Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra. that scripture states something that to a Gnostic can sound shocking. And that is, the consciousness can never become polluted. To us, that sounds wrong. We think, yes, it does. It becomes trapped in the ego. Right? To us, we think, what about the consciousness trapped in pride or lust? Isn't the consciousness polluted? No. There is pollution there. But if you cut away the pollution, the consciousness is as pure as it ever was. If you put pollution, if you take a glass of pure water and imagine that's the consciousness, and you dump a bunch of dirt in it, it's polluted superficially. You can't drink it. But if you separate the dirt and remove it, the water is as pure as it ever was. It retains its original purity. Ultimately, it cannot be polluted. Like space. Every element can be burned, but not space. That's the Ein Sof. At its ultimate level, that is what we are. But we have no cognizance of that. At our ultimate, deepest level is an innate purity of mind, a purity of consciousness that cannot be polluted and that is perfect and eternal. That is our genuine, true nature. The problem is we've forgotten it and built all these cages that trap all of its particles. And that's why Samael said, the particles of the Father that are in pain. Those are all the parts of the ultimate aspect of ourselves trapped in ego that suffer and make us suffer. There's a beautiful clue that you can find in analyzing and studying that aspect of Buddhist philosophy, and it's simply this. Any time that an ego is afflicting you, see the duality of it. Meaning, remember that it is not you. It is false. The ego is a craving or aversion. Always. The essence, the Ein Sof, simply is. Now your intellect can't do this. If you bring it into your intellect, you'll think, oh, I'm feeling all this anger, and I know it's anger, but I can't. It's anger, and I'm mad. It's not enough. To really grasp this, you have to meditate. You have to really sink into that depth in yourself. And then that anger, all of a sudden, seemingly for no reason, will just go away. Anyone experience that? By changing how you pay attention, you change what you experience. We make problems worse than they are. This is what this teaching tells us. We're making the anger a problem. What's powering the anger is ourselves. If we stop powering it, it goes away. It no longer can hurt us. This is how we begin to comprehend, develop cognizance, to stop empowering it. So if you are experiencing a very strong affliction, do something else. Take your attention away from it for a while. My recommendation is, in most cases, these kinds of afflictions are very much focused on oneself, on me. I want this, I want that, I don't want this, I don't want that. So take your attention away from yourself and do something for someone else. Serve. And in that compassion of serving and letting go of yourself, you'll suddenly realize, what was I so mad about? What was I so worried about or afraid of? Then meditate. If you don't meditate on that experience, it'll just happen again and again. And you'll fall into the same trap repeatedly. Meditate and comprehend it. In that comprehension, you will start to grasp that when you were in the experience of being afflicted by that anger, you believed that that anger was yourself, or that lust, or that pride, and it really feels like me. I'm mad, I'm hungry, I'm angry, I want this, I want that. And it feels like self, because you are powering it. But when you really comprehend that, you realize that was not self. It was a mistake. And this mistaken apprehension of self is what we're continually going through, but it's so subtle, we don't see it. Everyone here right now is suffering from this misapprehension of self, but we don't see it. Only by a deep cognizance and awareness of oneself can you start to see it and start to let go of it and break out of it. In other words, we have to go beyond what we see to see what we do not see in ourselves. We have to learn to see in a new way. If you're going through your life from day to day, always seeing things in the same way, you will get nothing new. Makes sense, doesn't it? We all want something new. You cannot have it if you're always seeing things in the same way. So open your eyes. Not the eyes of the body, but the eyes of the consciousness. Start seeing everything as if you've never seen it before, especially yourself. Continually watch and observe yourself as though you don't even know who you are. And watch and observe what's coming up in your body, in your heart, and your mind. These are our three brains. Always watching. Never attached, never getting sucked into, I want this, I don't want this. The duality of samsara. This is how we acquire jnana. This is a Sanskrit word that means knowledge. Jnana. J-N-A is how it's spelled. You've probably heard of jnana yoga, which is an introductory level to yoga in India, in which you study and teach, you learn the doctrine. It's intellectual. That's not what I'm talking about. Jnana is gnosis, knowledge from experience. That type of knowledge from experience that we acquire from observing ourselves in this way is a foundation. You see, with that level of knowledge, you're learning about the ego in the lower realms, primarily. But you also have to learn about the physical aspect, third dimension. And you need knowledge of the fourth dimensional aspect and the fifth dimensional aspect and the sixth. That's a lot of knowledge. Right now, we don't have any of that. We only know a little tiny bit about the physical world, and that's pretty much it. And even that is very questionable knowledge, because it's all stuff that people have told us to believe, and most of it there's no evidence. It's just beliefs. Jnana is real knowledge from experience. But real liberation doesn't begin until the sixth dimension. Right? That means we need knowledge from the sixth dimension beyond. And that has a different name in Sanskrit. It is prajna, which I've written here. Pra means that which is beyond. It's related to para, if you know gate, gate, para, gate. So beyond knowledge, or the knowledge of the beyond, this prajna has a very sophisticated etymology. In Hinduism and Buddhism, it's used slightly differently. I'm using it primarily in the Buddhist context, prajna. Prajna is the superior paramita, the highest perfection. If you've studied Buddhism, you know about the Prajna Paramita Sutra. If you know the mantra, gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisvaha, that is the mantra of prajna paramita. Pranya Paramita means knowledge of the perfection beyond. Pranya Paramita is the highest aspect of the soul. And it is this level of knowledge that begins here in Da'at. Da'at is a Hebrew word that means knowledge. Da'at is this sphere that bridges the ring past not, a great void that exists between the Trinity and the seven Sephirot that are in manifestation. Da'at is pranya. It is the knowledge that takes one beyond this void. This is where real liberation begins, from the sixth dimension. What is pranya? It is the wisdom of Christ. It is the type of knowledge that Christ has. When you look at the Hebrew terms here in the Trinity above pranya, da'at, you see bina, chokmah. Bina means intelligence. Chokmah means wisdom. If you unite those two, intelligent wisdom, cognizance, that is pranya. Is it getting too abstract? This is important. Pranya is the wisdom knowledge of Christ. It is a type of wisdom knowledge that has absolutely nothing to do with the intellect. It is pure cognizance illuminated by love. Now, I'm explaining this to you because at some point, I hope that you'll be serious enough in your meditation practice to experience it. And I want you to know what it is. I'm going to read to you a passage from Milarepa, in which, in a few words, he says everything I took 2 hours to say. So listen to the very specific terms that are in this quote, because step by step is what I just explained to you. He says, when your body is rightly posed and your consciousness absorbed in deep meditation, you may feel that thought and mind both disappear. Yet this is but the surface experience of dhyana. By constant practice and mindfulness thereon, one feels radiant self-awareness shining like a brilliant lamp. It is pure and bright as a flower. It is like the feeling of staring into the vast and empty sky. The awareness of voidness is limpid and transparent, but vivid. This non-thought, this radiant and transparent experience, is but the feeling of dhyana. With this good foundation, one should further pray to the three precious ones here above on the tree and penetrate to reality, which is the Ein Sof, by deep thinking and contemplation. He can thus tie the non-ego wisdom with the beneficial life rope of deep dhyana, with the power of kindness and compassion, and with the altruistic vow of bodhicitta. He can see direct and clear the truth of the enlightened path, of which nothing can be seen, yet all is clearly visioned. He sees how wrong were the fears and hopes of his own mind. Without arrival, he reaches the place of Buddha. Without seeing, he visions the Dharmakaya. Without effort, he does all things naturally. I wish I were that good of a teacher. Because that short passage is the whole course I just gave. But you have to know how to read it. He's describing something experiential in meditation. He's describing the whole path of gnosis and how one lives it in meditation practice. Study that scripture. Meditate on it. It can break a lot of chains in your mind. It can empower your practice. Now, when I was studying this scripture, I was also led to the same teaching, but more veiled in the Bible. But I'm not going to read it to you today because you'll just be confused. It's hard to grasp it. But I put the last line of that passage. It's Psalm 17, which is a prayer from David. And David is not a physical person from the past. David is symbolic of a tzaddik, a righteous one. In other words, a bodhisattva. And the last line of that says, "With righteousness I will see your face. Upon awakening, I will be satisfied by your image." That face is the greater face talked about in Kabbalah. It is the face of Keter, who turns his face and only shows us one side, the manifested side. The hidden side we don't see because it's the absolute. The prayer of David in Psalm 17 expresses exactly what Milarepo's explaining, that through ethics, through meditation, one can penetrate and see what cannot be seen with the terrestrial eyes. You see, Milarepa said he sees without seeing. And that's what David is saying. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, they say you can never see God or you'll die. It's true. Your ego cannot. But your essence can. And that is prana. It is the vision of Dat that sees the interior. From the point of view of prana, one can see and comprehend the absolute. This is why the true definition of bodhicitta is prana united with compassion. That's why bodhicitta is so hard to understand what that means. Real bodhicitta, or the awakening mind-heart, which is the auric embryo from which the ethereal man is born, the resurrected master of a bodhisattva, is this ability to perceive the unmanifested and the manifested simultaneously without contradiction. And this is why the Prajnaparamita says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness and form on the tree of life. Emptiness and form. Do you have any questions?
This may be you're looking at the abstract of the abstract, but you just gave a whole lecture about emptiness, and not once did we mention the aim. And so I wonder, like, what is the distinction between the aim and the aim self, and why did you discuss only the aim self?
The absolute, which is this level that we see at the very center of the tree of life, we talk about it, or Kabbalah talks about it in three aspects: Ein, Ein Sof, and Ein Sof Or. The reality is that they are all one and the same. Non-conceptual, non-existing, pure potentiality, uncreated light. Ein means nothingness, emptiness. It is that. It is also Ein Sof, limitless light, or limitless space. So conceptually, it's actually impossible to differentiate. And that's why when I talk about this, I usually say Ein Sof, because we're starting to talk about something that we can almost have a conception of. Ein Sof, or we think, oh, it's a light, it's a ray. It's not light like physical light. It's spiritual light, but to us, it's black. Very difficult to put in words, to convey anything of its real meaning. If you read that scripture from Milarepa, he talks about that in the beginning of it. That whole scripture, the whole teaching gave is on the Gnostic Teachings website. I only read one portion. But he talks about that light is black, which is the same thing that's said in Kabbalah. The essential meaning that we need to grasp from this is what emptiness actually means. It doesn't mean a lack of something. It doesn't mean that there's nothing there. It means there's something there that we don't get, that we don't see and we don't understand. It is something, but not like anything we can conceive of. When we say emptiness, we mean it has a type of reality that's different from our reality, and we call it void. It doesn't mean there's nothing there. So any other questions?
Back to separation.
Yeah.
As long as separation, I'm not going to give it up. I know I'm 97% ego, right? And that I know. But as I'm working on a defect and I'm comprehending it, I also know that, you know, the ego is suffering, right? So there is a separation.
Well, this, again, the point of these teachings about separation and non-separation is to break the mental concept of separation. The problem there is the concept of the duality. There may be a duality. And then when we analyze it in a certain way, there is. But from the ultimate point of view, there is not. The problems begin when we make these types of intellectual assumptions that I'm separate from my ego, or that I'm separate from God. Those assumptions are seeds that produce suffering. And they block us from having cognizance of what's real. And this is what's so difficult to grasp about prana and bodhicitta. What bodhicitta, fully realized and expressed bodhicitta in a person, is not mere compassion. It's the capacity to see two truths at the same time that to our intellect seem contradictory. And those two truths are, there is existence, there is non-existence. To the intellect, it makes no sense. How can something exist and not exist? But Buddhist philosophy very beautifully shows that these are both true. There is existence. But if you analyze it from another way, there is no existence. Prajna sees them both at the same time. That is 100% related to this idea of separation. Am I separate from my ego or not? Well, yes and no. But if you fall on the side of I'm separate from my ego, then you won't be able to fully comprehend that you're the one empowering that ego. You need to see that you are it and that you are not it at the same time. Any questions back there? Oh, okay.
It's not home,
any other questions here? Yes?
Just as a comment about what you're talking about, it's like if you look into like quantum mechanics, you can see how you have an electron particle or is it a wave function?
Exactly the same.
And you find it depends on how it's perceived in the context, who's observing it, or what's going on. It's exactly the same thing.
Yeah, quantum mechanics is mapping the precise function. And that's why the quantum physicists are so interested in Buddhism. Because Buddhist philosophy helps them understand the behavior of quanta. And we need to grasp that in our meditation. It's that deep penetrating insight into how all these laws interact that will help us to break the chains that are binding us. This isn't just philosophical stuff that's interesting. It's critical. We're in bondage because we don't see how nature actually works. That's why we're trapped. That's why we suffer. And getting to the level of being a great spiritual master like a Buddha and having a lot of followers and everything else does not solve the problem. It can actually make it worse. That's why Master Samael said that one is often closer to liberation when one is a great sinner as compared to one who's a great saint. The great saint feels like everything's fine. The great sinner is the one who sees there's a problem, and they suffer. And they're the ones with a point of view that can perceive more of what's really going on. Where a great saint, they're happy. They're enjoying nirvana. And that's also in the quote from Milarepa. He talks about that. Any other questions? Is there liberation through devolution? There is a type of liberation. The process of devolution is where the soul, who is burdened with karmic residue, is processed through nature to be purged. So that soul is placed in a great cycle that we call hell or samsara, where the forces of nature blitz that burdened soul to cleanse it. And it's a huge, long process of suffering. In the end, that soul is, quote, liberated, but only liberated from hell, only liberated from that cleansing. But it is not liberated in terms of cognizance, in terms of knowledge. In essence, that soul who comes out of the cycle of hell starts back where they were when they entered, having gained nothing but a lot of suffering. Real liberation comes through prajna, which is knowledge, and that can never arrive mechanically through the processes of nature. That is something that one has to acquire through effort, through work. That's why few attain it. It's an interesting contradiction in many religions, or spiritual groups, I should say. Most religions don't affirm this. It's more like these modern groups that are trying to get popular and make money that say that all human beings are evolving to become great angels. No religion says that. And there's no evidence for that. And if it were true, it would have happened before. Because nature works in cycles. It repeats itself daily. So if that were true, and if all human beings were destined to be angels, then we should have been angels already, or should be close to it already. There should be some evidence of that. There isn't. That's why there are so few very great masters. Very few. Because it's not easy to reach that. It's a conscious evolution, not mechanical. Any other questions? Please.
Is it in the sixth dimension where the experience of samadhi begins to...
A good question. I wanted actually to explain a little bit about the term samadhi. In the previous lecture and many lectures, we've talked about Patanjali's yoga sutras, and which is also called Raja Yoga. And in his aphorisms, he presents an eightfold path of meditation. And we generally simplify it to seven, because the first two, yama and niyama, relate to ethics. The last one is samadhi. And that word samadhi means many things, depending on how it's used. If you look in a Sanskrit dictionary, I think there's, I don't know, 15 or 20 different meanings for the word samadhi. It can mean meditative absorption. It can also mean the position of your neck. So in Sanskrit, people say, oh, your neck is in samadhi. So the term is very loosely used. Moreover, in Buddhism, the term samadhi is not used in the same way it's used in Hinduism. In the Gnostic tradition, we use the word samadhi to talk about a state of consciousness where the ego is not trapping the consciousness. In other words, we call it an ecstasy. The essence is freed from the ego and has pure perception of the truth. That's what we call samadhi. In Hinduism, it doesn't mean that. In Hinduism, samadhi means one-pointed concentration. It would be equivalent to the Buddhist term dhyana, or the Buddhist term shamatha, or the Buddhist term dhyana, zen, chana, shine in Tibetan. All those terms refer to one-pointed concentration. That's how you need to understand there's some diversity in the terms there. But in terms of gnosis, there are many types of samadhis or experiences where the consciousness escapes from the ego. A samadhi can happen in any dimension. And there are many types. Hinduism talks about two primary forms with different varieties of those forms. And they are complicated and a lot of terminology that I'm not going to throw on you because I know you're already confused. But to answer the question, there are many types of samadhi in any level. You can have a samadhi in any level of the tree of life. In terms of the ego, letting go of the consciousness, and the consciousness being able to perceive. That's how we can see all that, is having what we would call a samadhi. In Buddhism, it would be called dhyana. So if you read the quote from Milarepa, he keeps talking about dhyana. But really, we're talking about samadhi in the Gnostic term. So there's a little flexibility in those terms. Just be aware of it. Does that answer your question?
So in one of the lectures, you were talking about the Dzogchen technique where you're watching your thoughts, and then you also said to periodically refresh your awareness.
Right.
So at that point, it would be a gap where there is no thought.
Well, what I'm talking about in the lecture today is an extension of that.
So I'm saying, so that at some point there's going to be no thought.
If you are able to follow the instructions of meditation, which is to start releasing or breaking free of all those chains, physical sensations, energy, thought, emotion, etc., the mind will naturally settle. The natural state of the mind is to be perfectly calm, serene. No thought. That's the natural state. So yeah, if you follow the instruction and don't allow these discursive emotions and thoughts and energies to be active in you through the day, over day and day and day and day and practicing meditation, the mind will start settling naturally on its own. It doesn't take effort. That's why we gave the whole course Meditation Without Exertion. It's about that. And then that experience of no thought will arise. That is what that scripture from Milarepa is explaining. The experience of no thought is only the beginning of starting to go deeper to actually see and have experience of prana. The experience of no thought or a state of dhyana is only the first superficial level of that. So when you experience it, follow his advice. He says, when you experience that, don't become attached. Don't think that that's it. And a lot of people fall into that trap. They practice meditation. They get to a point where they experience no thought, and they experience a kind of ecstasy or pleasure, and they think, woohoo, I'm enlightened. Nope. It's just having serenity. It's good. And there are many levels of serenity. You have to go past that. No attachment. Deeper. Step by step, patiently, with the attention placed in precisely the right way, veils start to be removed from the consciousness. It takes patience. It takes persistence. It takes a lot of, you could say, actualization. It's a process in which you become very attuned to how these energies work in your consciousness. And to really succeed in it, you have to have a lot of willpower, because the ego works really hard to keep you from it. Gradually, as he explained in that scripture I read, you can reach the stage where you experience prana, and that's the ability to perceive the emptiness. And it's the same experience that Samael and Vior described that he had when he was 18. I know all of us wished we had that experience when we were 18, but if we'd been meditating through our teen years instead of running around with our friends, we would have. So we can have that experience now. It just takes a lot of practice, a lot. Question back here?
If in a moment one is afflicted by lust and because of experience one decides to not feed it, to not empower it, this is not considered repression? Is this considered cognizance? Because if it is, it doesn't feel very cognizant.
That's a good question. So the question is, if in a moment of experience lust we decide not to feed it, but instead try to transform that, is that repression? And if it isn't repression, it sure doesn't feel very good. That's a great question, and it's true. The endeavor to properly transform energy, to transform impressions, requires experience. It requires trying it and trying it and trying it until you start to feel and become sensitive to the energy that's in motion. This is not something you're going to get the first time you try it. Not going to happen. In the beginning, you're going to make the same mistakes that a child makes when learning to ride a bicycle. You're going to get on the bike, and you're going to fall to the left or to the right. And you're going to feel hurt, and you will get hurt. In other words, sometimes when you're trying to transform that energy, you'll repress too much. Sometimes you'll indulge. But through experience, you learn to balance. And you start to get to a point where you can sense and feel how that energy is moving in your three brains, and how to cognizantly transform that. This is the secret of Tantra. And the level of Tantra, Tantrayana, teaches basically this. The same way that a discursive emotion like lust produces suffering and traps soul, that same energy can liberate the soul if the soul knows how to use it. But that use of energy is not through indulgence or repression. It's through an inner equilibrium. And to acquire that, you can't be taught. You have to learn on your own. Like learning to walk, like learning to ride a bicycle, you have to learn cognizantly by observing and being sensitive to energy in yourself. When you learn it, here's how you know you did it right. You'll already know if you did it wrong. You'll know, because you're going to suffer, either at that moment or after. You'll suffer from repression, and you'll suffer from indulgence. If you do it right, you will get cognizance, peace. You will understand something. That peace is not in the intellect. It's peace in the heart. Peace in the body. Relaxation. Calmness. As a simple, stupid example, if you're working on some sort of anger that you get about your pride when somebody speaks to you in a certain way, let's say you have a person that always talks rude to you and you can't stand it, it's driving you crazy, and you've tried everything to deal with this person, but it still bothers you, and you're attempting to work with this practice, first you'll try avoiding them. That doesn't work, because they still come around and irritate you. And then when you see them, you try to say, okay, I'm going to be right here and let you just say whatever you want, but you still get bothered. So see, that's the two sides. The answer is, whether they come or not, whether they say anything or not, you hear it, and it's just air. That's the very first part. It's just words. It only means something if you think it means something. It only hurts you if you empower it to hurt you. And you can think about this. If that person is a coworker and they're always criticizing you and you're feeling the pain, you can say, what if they were not the age they are now? What if they were only a year or two old and they were saying the same thing? Would it hurt me? No. It wouldn't hurt you because you'd know this was a child. What if they were 80 or 90 years old and saying that? It wouldn't hurt you. Because you think, oh, they're just old. They're suffering. Why should I let that bother me? And then another step is when you see that person and you realize they're saying that because they're suffering. That person has a lot of anger, a lot of pride, a lot of pain, and they're expressing it through their words. Why should I get angry with them? I should have compassion for them. I should love them. That is cognizance. And if that becomes deep cognizance, no matter what they say, you will always smile. And you will love them. And you will treat them with the most kindness and care that you would give any person. Because you know in them is a being, a God, who has this human soul that is suffering in pain, and they need help. That is cognizance. And the same thing happens with every ego that we have. That's how we transform it. Observation, analysis, relaxation, patience, non-reaction. But cognizance. It applies to lust, to anger, to pride, to greed, everything. And it doesn't come overnight. It comes from ordeal after ordeal, event after event, transforming. You see the goal? Do you get the goal? It's to become a good person. Not someone who's faking it. Not someone who's trying to act like a good person and put on a good show, but someone who actually has real wisdom. Pranya. In other words, that attitude I just explained is how Christ should express through the soul. That wisdom of Christ. Pranya is Christic wisdom. That attitude of loving each other, of not reacting, of not getting angry, that is Christic. You can call yourself a Buddhist or a Gnostic or a Muslim. If you have that attitude, you are showing the love of Christ. Christ is not a person. It is an energy. Our goal is to become a soul, a diamond soul, that reflects and transmits that light without any obscuration. No ego, no pride, no envy, no gluttony, no lust, none of that to obscure that light. So everything we do, we feel, we think, we say is Christic. That comes from cognizance, prana. That's real spiritual experience. Another question? No? Okay. Any more? Yes?
What is the difference in between inner chat and thoughts?
Between which?
Inner chat, like talk to yourself.
Oh, chat, like chatter?
And chatting all day, chatting within you.
But the difference between chatter and thought? There's not really any difference from the point of view of Gnostic or Buddhist psychology. The inner thought process, all that is a vibration in the mind that's being produced by something. Inner chatter, inner thoughts, memories, all the different things that flow through the mind is just a vibration of energy. What makes the difference is what's producing it. If it's cognizant, that's one thing. Because God is very smart. Our inner God, our inner Buddha, thinks very beautiful thoughts, but doesn't have to think. Right? There is thought on every level of the tree of life. But we have to see in us, are these thoughts Christic, Buddhic, Atmic, right? Or are they Klepotic? And that's a question only the individual can answer through analysis. Okay, we'll end there because that was long. Yeah. Thank you.
To learn more about what you learned in this lecture, we invite you to explore the books published by Glorian Publishing, available from booksellers worldwide. You may also be interested in online courses or upcoming retreats, all of which you can learn about at GnosticTeachings.org. All of this has been made possible by the financial support of listeners like you. Will you help others to benefit from this knowledge? Most spiritual schools recommend a donation of $10 to $20 per lecture. Every donation helps. Make a donation now at GnosticTeachings.org. Thank you. May all beings be happy. Yeah.